From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. Before I introduce today's guest, there's important news on the legislative front. H.R. 3076, the Postal Service Reform Act of 2021, which was introduced earlier this week, was approved by voice vote without amendment by the House Committee on Oversight and Reform. The core of the bill would repeal the Postal Service's requirement to pre-fund retiree health benefits and would integrate Medicare and FEHBP for postal employees retiring on or after January 1, 2023. Other provisions in the bill include greater postal performance transparency, clarification of the Postal Service's authority to partner with governmental agencies, and a series of reporting requirements relating to rate setting and the implementation of the Postal Service's 10-year plan. Upon introduction, H.R. 3076 was also referred to the House Ways and Means Committee and the House Energy and Commerce Committee because of its provisions relating to Medicare. As of yet, those committees have yet to schedule a meeting to consider the measure. The Oversight and Reform Committee also favorably reported H.R. 3077, the Postal Service Improvement Act, and it approved that bill by a vote of 23-17. The bill, as introduced, would enable the Postal Service to better track mail election ballots and would provide postal employees with the same paid parental leave benefits as provided to other federal employees. In addition, the committee approved by voice vote two NAPS-promoted amendments offered by Representative Jerry Connolly of Virginia. The first Connolly Amendment extended Merit System Protection Board appeal rights to EAS-level postal employees who are presently denied that right. The second Connolly Amendment would require the prompt commencement of EAS pay talks upon the imminent expiration of an existing pay package and would make the findings and recommendations of the legally prescribed Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service fact-finding panel binding on the Postal Service. The committee also approved amendments to maintain current mail service standards, provide congressional access to postal facilities, finance the acquisition of electric postal vehicles, authorize the use of postal employees during the 2030 decennial census, and merge the functions of the Postal Inspector General with the Postal Regulatory Commission Inspector General. While the House Oversight and Reform Committee was considering H.R. 3076 and H.R. 3077, the Senate confirmed the nomination of Amber McReynolds to the Postal Service Board of Governors, and a day prior to that consideration, the Senate confirmed Ron Stroman to the Board of Governors. Nominee Anton Hajar still awaits Senate floor action. Now on to our guest. I want to welcome to Naps Chat Steve Hutkins, the administrator and founder of the popular postal website, SaveThePostOffice.com. Steve is a retired New York University English professor who lives in a small town in the New York Hudson Valley. Steve has no affiliation with the Postal Service, never worked for it, nor does any of his family members work for the Postal Service. Nevertheless, like most Americans, he has a strong affection for the continued vitality of his local post office. With regard to Steve's website, Save the Post Office, it is a decade-old internet postal portal, which provides some of the most detailed and easy-to-comprehend analysis of the Postal Service and its operations. Welcome to Naps Chat, Steve.
Well, thanks for that nice intro, Bob, and thanks for having me on your podcast.
Let me ask you this first question, and I think that you're surprised about the interest, the wide interest in your website and the information it provides. Why do you think there's such interest in it?
Well, it's hard to say. There's just so much interest right now in the post office because of all the controversies generated by Trump's attacks and DeJoy and the election mail issues and the dependence on the post office for packages during the pandemic. So a lot of it, the interest in the website is just generated. It's a function of the interest in the post office. And when people Google around for more information, they find newspaper articles and government reports, and they might stumble upon a website, but it's probably by a stakeholder. So when they find something that has a different perspective, maybe something a little closer to their own, like a regular citizen, they maybe find something interesting. And like you said, there's just a ton of stuff on it, so there's something for everybody. And since it's been around so long, it shows up on Google searches and so on. And it also, for a long time, my friend Mark Jameson wrote for the website, and he was a retired postmaster who really knew a lot about the history of the post office. So his post always garnered a lot of attention, and really thankful for him for that. And, you know, I'm always really, like you said, I'm really surprised that as many people look at it as they do. But I also have to remember there's over 500,000 postal workers and another 500,000 people that are involved in the industry. So there's a huge audience to draw on, and I only get a tiny, tiny fraction of it.
Well, it's been pretty significant, you know, but as I said, SaveThePostOffice.com has been in existence for more than a decade. It started as an effort to save post offices from closings and suspensions. Now it's much more. What's the reason for the evolution of the website from being just Save the Post Offices now to much more expansive exploration of postal operations?
That's a good question. It did start just with a focus on closing post offices. Is that what was going on in 2011? And that's what got me motivated. Like, why are they closing post offices? Why would they close my post office? Why would they sell off a historic New Deal era post office building? So I started looking into that, and then I just got hooked because the Postal Service is such an interesting institution, and it's so deep, and there's so much to explore about it. And then they started to talk about the network rationalization plan came around in 2012 to consolidate plants. And I never, ever thought about mail processing plants, but there's one nearby in Newburgh. So I got interested in that. And one thing led to another after that, getting interested in rate increases, like the exigent rate issue back in 2015. And one thing led to another. There's lots of legislation to look at, and it's all connected. So why close post offices was connected to everything else.
On a related question to the previous one, over the past 10 years, what have you learned about the Postal Service that you did not previously know?
Well, when I started, I knew nothing, so I've learned a lot. I'm not sure what my main takeaways would be. I think one of the things I saw right away, and that's really become, you know, it's still the case, there's so much misinformation about the post office out there. The journalists who focus on it, usually it's, you know, they don't stay with it. It's just a story they write, and then they move on to the next thing. And the Postal Service itself is not always as straightforward as it should be about what it's doing and why it's doing it. So, you know, that's been a big lesson. And the other is I don't think I ever realized before how the Postal Service is under attack all the time. And there's so many forces interested in downsizing and dismantling it and outsourcing it. And I was just like, why attack this? But then you realize it's part of the attack on other public services, public schools, public transportations, and so on. And there's just a lot of people out there who don't like, you know, public infrastructures and public services. So they promulgate the myth, the scarcity myth, that we can't afford a postal service like we've had in the past, and the only thing to do is to privatize it, and private enterprises do better. And they don't like seeing a public institution succeed. And the popularity of the post office and postal workers is a daily reminder that the government can do some things well.
Does it surprise you, or maybe I'm mischaracterizing this, but in the past, when you first started the blog, most of the attacks at the Postal Service or relating to the Postal Service came from outside the Postal Service, primarily its competitors. More recently, at least the perception is that some of the attacks are coming from inside the operation. Do you sense that also?
No, I'm not sure I would agree with that. My sense back then was that that was a lot of it was coming from the top. I'm not sure if it was in response to these outside forces, but I was always wondering, why does the Postal Service want to close post offices? It seemed like a self-destructive thing. And I know there were pushes from other, you know, outside the Postal Service, but I'm not sure if it's more internal now than it was, although the unpopularity of the current Postmaster General might indicate otherwise. But it seems like what I've seen over the past 10 years is just a continuation of something that started long before that, back in going back to 1970 when they created the Postal Service, and the commission that created it was already set on trying to privatize it eventually, and the sort of corporate entity that they established was step in that direction. So most of what's happened in the last 50 years could be seen as a step-by-step piecemeal privatization process, including, you know, the growing dependence on work share pre-sorting and everything else. The pushback from, say, UPS over the past few years goes way back to the early days of the Postal Service. So there's nothing really new there either.
Let me pivot a little bit to another issue, in that there's heightened attention right now to postal performance, particularly in light of the Postal Regulatory Commission's consideration of a required advisory opinion on certain aspects of the Postal Service's 10-year strategic plan. You registered as a private citizen as an intervener in the postal regulatory process. Why did you intervene?
Well, I thought maybe I would want to be able to pose some questions, which is one of some interrogatories that the interveners can do without going through a motion to ask the presiding officer to ask the questions, which I've done in the past. And I thought maybe I would have some questions, and I still may, but the questions have started to come in, the first phase of the interrogatories, and they're really covering the bases. The presiding officer has been fantastic, and postal watchdog Doug Carlson, who's been at this for many years, has posed several interrogatories, and the mailers have started, and they're covering more things than I could possibly imagine. So I'm not sure if I'll have a lot to add, but I was just doing what I always do with the PRC and keeping an eye on things, and if I have something to add, I will.
You should know the PRC actually reads your website also in my conversations. So you're pretty – you cross
nice
a lot of different interests in terms of your readership. One of the issues that we've been talking about are the changes in this number of zip code pairs that will experience longer transit times for the conveyance of mail within the context of the 10-year strategic plan. Could you explain about the significance of zip code pairs, and why should Americans care about zip code pairs?
That's a good one, Bob. I didn't know what a zip code pair was, basically, until about a couple of weeks ago, I think. I knew that they existed because they have them, the data's on Postal Pro website, which mailers use, and they pay a lot of attention to those pairs, but I didn't pay any attention to them until I really saw the role that they were playing in the material submitted for the advisory opinion by the Postal Service, because the zip code pairs, if anybody listening doesn't know what they are, it refers to the three-digit prefix for every zip code, and there are nearly 1,000 of them, 904, as a matter of fact, for the contiguous United States. And each zip code, then, is paired with every other one, so that's 900 times 900, that's 810,000 zip code pairs, and they provide the data for every single one of them on what the transit time between pairs is in terms of distance and time, and they provide the volume data, et cetera, for all of these zip code pairs. And with them, you can begin to visualize, if you convert that data into maps, as I did on my most recent blog post, you can see what the service standards look like geographically on the map, and you see that the two-day area, the area that if you mail something, it's supposed to take 2 days to get there, is getting much, much smaller, about a third of the size that it used to be, and about a tenth of the size that it used to be 10 years ago, and the area getting 3-day enlarges, and then half the country, depending on where you're starting from, is going to be subject to a 4- and 5-day service standard. And this only became apparent to me, even though it was sort of spelled out in text, it only became apparent when you could see it in a map. And it really shows the extent to which so much of the mail, 40% of the volume and 60% of the zip code pairs, are going to be downgraded to a lower standard of 1 day, or in some cases, 2 days. So the average person will be impacted because their mail is going to take a lot longer to get to where it's going than it used to.
Now, one of the items within that zip code pair analysis is that about 10% of the mail, and this deals with transportation of mail, about 10% of the mail, despite the reduction in the air transport of the mail, moving it to ground, will continue to move by air.
That's one of the interesting things about the way they presented the materials, because they defined the service standard areas in terms of miles and drive time. So 3 days is what you could reach by truck in, you know, within a 3-day standard. So it's about 1,000 miles. Then the 4 days is 2,000 miles, and the 3 day is more than that, 2,000 to 3,000 miles. So it's defined in terms of driving time, but then you look at what the plan is, and they're only moving a relatively small part of the volume from air to truck, about 10%. So it's, why do they lower the standards for the rest of the zip code pairs, the rest of the country, if they're only changing a relatively small portion of the air volume to transit? And I looked more deeply into it, and of course the answer to the question was obvious. They eventually plan to shift the rest of the volume from air to truck. But for some reason, they're only presenting the plan now, showing a portion of that transition taking place. And I'm not sure why they're doing it that way, except that it will, by phasing it in gradually, will allow them to perhaps avoid some of the problems that would occur if they did it all at once. But it's there in the text of the request, but it's somewhat misleading because it makes it seem as if not all that much is going to change in terms of the dependence on air.
Let's talk about two zip code pairs. Let's say my hometown in New York, 113, which is Flushing. And I want to send something to Los Angeles. I think it's 900. I'm going to 900. I would expect that that mail would continue to go by air. You have two big significant air mail facilities at LAX, at JFK, and it continues to go that way, yet I'm changing the standard despite the fact I'm not changing the mode of transport at this time. Does that make any sense?
Well, some of the additional time is so that they have more slack time to manage operations at the facilities. So they can, for example, they can hold a truck until it's a higher percentage of the truck is filled rather than sending it off light. So the extra time will give them some slack time in terms of that. But why are they making a 5-day service standard when they're going to continue to fly the mail to Los Angeles? Doesn't make any sense to me, except that they eventually plan to truck the mail to Los Angeles, and they didn't want to come back and ask for a new change in the service standards. That this just sets the groundwork for the gradual evolution of increased dependence on surface transport.
One of the other areas that you've taken a deep dive into is potentially discriminatory treatment of some areas of the country with respect to speed of delivery. Could you explain?
Well, that became apparent when, if you mail something from New York to Los Angeles, it's subject to the 5-day standard. But if you mail the same thing from St. Louis, for example, it's a 4-day standard because the distance between St. Louis and Los Angeles is 2,000 miles, and from New York it's 3,000 miles, and that's the difference between the 4- and 5-day standard. So some areas of the country, particularly those on the coast, will have more of their mail subject to the 4- and 5-day standards than areas in the middle of the country where They may hardly have any regions that are 5-day, and the 4-day regions will be smaller and more of it will be reached by 3-day. So it occurred to me that everybody isn't going to be treated the same, whereas this is totally different than the way it is now. Because right now there's a 2-day area, which is about 100 and a certain, you know, number of miles from the point of origin, and then the rest of the country, no matter where you send it, contiguous United States, is 3 days. But now the map is going to look more like the periodicals map and the parcels map. It's going to be zoned, essentially, and it'll depend on where things are going from and to that determine how long it takes. There won't be a uniform 3 days the way there is now, so there will be the potential for what I call a geographic discrimination. And if the PRC finds that persuasive, there is a statute about not discriminating against users of the mail, so that could become a factor. They, in the request, make a point out of saying the data shows that there'll be no discrimination between urban and rural, but doesn't say anything about possible discriminations based on geography.
Before we started the program and I introduced you, I talked a little bit about legislation that was passed by the House Oversight and Reform Committee. And one of the provisions in the legislation, H.R. 3076, is something that you initiated on your website, and that was a dashboard to monitor performance. The legislation calls for a publicly available website for the citizen mailer to monitor postal performance. What do you think about that innovation? Or is it an innovation since it appeared first on your website?
Well, I think it would be a great idea. The Postal Service actually does have a sort of a very simplified portal where they post some of the basic quarterly numbers in a chart format, but it doesn't provide very much. And the reason that I created mine was that there was so much information on service performance coming out of those lawsuits that took place in the summer and fall over election mail. One of the great things about those lawsuits, besides motivating the Postal Service to really perform well during the election and delivering mail ballots, was that they provided weekly service performance data almost in real time, like a week. And that was unavailable, and it was hard to get to that data. So I started putting it on the website where journalists and mailers and average people could see what was going on, because the charts showing the performance are extremely revealing. In fact, the whole election mail business, the controversies over it, got started when a few insider charts that were from an Ames conference meeting were made public, and they were being held up in Congress. And wow, those charts really showed how DeJoy's operational changes made service performance crash in a way that anecdotal reports in the news couldn't make so clear. So I thought those charts are great, and I started making lots of charts, and then it was just made sense to try and put them all together on one page on the website, so that if a journalist contacted me, I could just refer them to that and walk them through it. And the stuff on the PRC website is often hard to find, and I thought it would be helpful if it was in a more accessible format. And if the government wants to take that on, or the Postal Service wants to take that on, I'll be happy to hand it off to them.
Let me ask you, as you were analyzing your own data as a result of the lawsuits, could you come to any conclusions as to what effect the pandemic had on performance as compared to operational changes that occurred during the summer, as compared to the dump of parcels towards the end of the year?
That's a great question. Like, what has been causing all the problems for the past year now? During March through July, the pandemic was well underway, and the Postal Service is already beginning to experience some employee availability issues, and the package surge obviously had started, and service performance was not impacted in any noticeable way. The first time that there was any noticeable drop-off in the numbers occurred almost exactly when DeJoy implemented his operational changes concerning cutting back on overtime and changing the late and extra trips out of processing plants, et cetera. And things just dropped right off as soon as he did that. They started to gradually recover, but they never fully recovered. And then later, as Christmas came around, the numbers started to plummet even worse than they had when DeJoy implemented his policy, his operational changes. So that became, it became clear that that was much more the cause, the package surge, than operational changes. Then we have the most recent quarter, January to March, the PRC just submitted, those numbers were just submitted to the PRC on Monday of this week, and they show some improvement in some areas, but the numbers are terrible. There are the single piece mail with a 3-day service standard is averaging about 58% on time, and there are many districts that are below 50% on time. This is 25 points or so below where it was last year at this time before the pandemic started. So things have not gotten much better, and at this point, I would, rather than asking whether DeJoy's operational changes last summer are still having some impact, the question would be, after a year dealing with the pandemic, why are things still not resolved, and why is performance still so bad? Worse than it's been in any time that I've looked at it. The only other time in all of the last 10 years that I've been looking at this was in 2015, when they made the operational changes, closing plants and changing the operational windows as part of the last time they did a change in service standards, when the average time, average delivery time went from like 2 days to 2.5 days. And now they're going to go from 2.5 days to 3 days with under the new plan, which is really crazy because they used to be able to deliver about 60%, 70% of the mail overnight. The average delivery time was about 1.7 days. And here we're going to be, hardly any of the mail is going to be overnight. And most of it's going to be 3, 4, and 5 days. And the average delivery time is going to be almost 3 days. It's just going in the wrong direction. And that just can't be a healthy phenomenon for the post office in the long term. It drives away business, and it's bad for the reputation of the Postal Service, and it's not a good thing. The mailers are obviously upset about it, but I think the more people know about it, the rest of the country is not going to like it either.
One of the fundamental issues I've been talking about is the concept of strategic differentiation when you're in a competitive market, which means if I'm the Postal Service and I'm competing with Amazon, UPS, FedEx, or Walmart, or whoever, how do I differentiate myself? And customers are now demanding speed and promptness of the delivery of their products. If that is the metric by which consumers are determining who they shop by, how does the Postal Service compete if the impact is they're reducing their performance?
Well, I think, I guess I would want to differentiate between what's going on now with the service standards and the advisory opinion and the general attitude about getting my packages as fast as possible, which is where the competition with Amazon, FedEx, and UPS comes. Because we're talking about the mail, the letter mail, the first class mail with the service standards. And so slowing down that mail is different from competing over the speed of package delivery with the private carriers. I'm not sure what they have planned in terms of the speed of delivery with the competitive products, because they don't have to report those the way they do with the market dominant products. And I have no idea if their plans are to speed that up or slow it down or whatever. In fact, most of the money that they spend on air transportation, it's over $3 billion a year, is not for the mail, but for Priority Express and on the parcel business, not for the mail. The cutting back on air transport for the mail is a relatively small amount. They're talking about saving a couple $100 million out of over $3 billion on air transport. And even if they cut out all of the air transport, it's less than half a billion out of the over $3 billion that they're spending on it. So I'm not sure about the sort of this strategic differentiation and the competition issues. It may be that they're cutting back on their commitment to first-class mail because they want to put more of their effort and money and time, et cetera, into the package business where they see the future. And if first-class mail falls by the wayside in the process, so be it. In fact, the first-class mail looks like it's going to be treated like a marketing mail at this point in terms of speed and delivery, putting it together and, you know, kind of integrating the delivery and so on. So and maybe there'll come a time when we won't even know what first-class mail is. It'll just be like all the rest of it, and it'll have lost what it once meant. And if you want anything to go with real speed, you're going to have to mail it priority and pay whatever it costs, the $5 or $10 instead of the 55 cents or whatever we're at now.
Steve, I want to thank you for joining me today. This has been enlightening.
Thank you. Thank you again for inviting me to do this.
And I want to thank NapsChat listeners for logging on this week. If you enjoy NapsChat, please leave us a positive review in the Apple Podcast Store. And more importantly, share NapsChat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, stay safe.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.